Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinczyk. On today's show, we'll hear a presentation I gave at the University of Chicago on the topic of participatory economics and finance. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Thomas Jefferson would have been proud. On May 14th, more than 500 people packed a room on the seventh floor of the museum in Washington, D.C. to discuss the state of journalism, public media, and the internet in America.
At a moment when technology and media are rapidly changing, the Free Press Summit explored the future of the internet and the fate of journalism in the 21st century. But surprisingly, the 200-year-old words of Thomas Jefferson took center stage throughout the day, beginning with the opening remarks by John S. and James L. Knight Foundation President Alberto Ibarguen. He recalled Jefferson's famous quote, "If I had to choose between government without newspapers and newspapers without government, I wouldn't hesitate to choose the latter. But I should mean that every man should receive those papers and be capable of reading them." That second line, "everyone should receive those papers and be capable of reading them," is often left out. But as Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver explained,
"Jefferson understood the importance of linking distribution and access and engagement with actual production of journalism. The problem, though, is in modern Washington, questions of media and those of infrastructure are treated separately. They operate in their own silos of law, policy, and advocacy, and this separation has to end. We need a strong market for journalism and freedom of the press, and we need to ensure that information reaches all corners of the country and that everybody can engage. We must and can have both."
Free Press released a new book at the event called Changing Media: Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Some of its authors took to the stage to present their research. Research Director S. Derek Turner spoke about how the blame for America's broadband failure rests with the Federal Communications Commission.
Before the ink was even dry on the 1996 Act, the powerful telecommunications giants and their army of lobbyists went straight to work obstructing and undermining the competition the new law was intended to create. By the dawn of the 21st century, what they could not get overturned in the courts was gladly undone by a new FCC eager to deregulate these corporate giants, all in the name of the free market. So instead of protections against monopolies, consumers have been left with high prices, few choices, and a duopoly of phone and cable companies.
Senior Program Director Craig Aaron talked about why journalism should be considered a public service, not just another commodity.
So what should we do? First, we need to agree on what we're trying to save. This is not just about newspapers. It's about newsrooms and news gathering. This isn't about protecting old institutions or propping up old business models. It's about serving local communities. And it's really about understanding that journalism is a public service. It is not just another business. And the crisis we have in journalism is a national issue that requires a national solution.
Acting chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael Copps, covered a range of issues and proposals for change at the FCC over the coming year, from stronger public interest obligations for broadcasters to the national broadband policy the commission has been tasked with creating.
Every generation faces the challenge, and today, strengthening democracy means building media democracy. The media agenda is at the center of democracy's agenda. If we work at it, really work at it, you and I can realize the dream. Us now.
Susan Crawford, a member of President Barack Obama's National Economic Council, also spoke. She affirmed the president's commitment to high-speed broadband access for all.
Broadband, it's the new essential infrastructure. It's true that access to broadband doesn't guarantee economic success, but lack of access to broadband will guarantee economic stagnation and decline.
And NPR President Vivian Schiller declared that her news organization was positioned to increase investigative reporting.
But I feel we have a special responsibility also to expand in the area of investigative journalism. We do some, we do it very well, but we don't do nearly enough.
A highlight of the event was a roundtable with moderator Ray Suarez of PBS, Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott, Senate Commerce Committee's Jessica Rosenworcel, venture capitalist Ram Shriram, and former FCC Chairman Reed Hunt and Michael Powell. Here's Michael Powell.
I think that the Bush administration did fail in that the president and the White House never committed to the broadband policy, and I'm much more encouraged that the current president speaks of it.
Next week, Media Minutes will take a look at the afternoon session, which shifted the focus from the speakers at the front of the room to the participants who were seated at the tables.
To see the speeches, read the report, and a whole lot more, visit freepress.net/summit.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The Royal Dutch Shell Oil Corporation is on trial in New York, charged in a civil suit with complicity in the death of Nigerian writer and environmental activist Ken Sarowiwa and eight comrades in 1995. Sarowiwa's execution drew world attention to the environmental catastrophe that oil production has brought to the Delta region of the Niger River, home to the Ogoni people. Sarowiwa and his co-defendants were tried by a military government, but Shell Oil is charged with collaboration in the hangings and in the torture of many other Ogonis, all to facilitate multi-billion-dollar profits. Multinational corporations everywhere are following the case, fearing they too may be called to account for their symbiotic relationships with murderous regimes in the resource-rich regions of the world. Nigeria's environmental degradation is a byproduct of the moral and political rot that flows from neocolonialism. It is the physical manifestation of the total surrender of national sovereignty to foreigners, like Shell Oil, by those native classes that rule the lands for the benefit of foreigners. To put one's country's resources at the disposal of foreigners is the ultimate corruption, which leads to every other conceivable crime. It is a false dichotomy to separate the corruption of Nigeria's government, military or civilian, from the predatory presence of big oil. The two are locked in the deepest embrace. The foreign corporations pay the regime to maintain peace, and the regime reciprocates by imposing on the people a peace of the dead. There are other sources of corruption in the developing world, other contradictions between people and their governments, but the dominance of economic resources by foreigners exacerbates every other division in society. The competition to get into the foreigners' money flow becomes the great game of national political life. The bigger the money flow, the greater the imperative to keep the people in check. The police and army serve as paid thugs for the foreigners' protection. The national debasement is total. Nigeria's most important city, Lagos, is also one of the most expensive in the world, yet 70% of Nigerians subsist on a dollar or less a day. There is no greater corruption imaginable. In court, Shell Oil will seek to present itself as an innocent party, even a victim of African brutality and corruption. Shell is more properly compared to a businessman who hires a hitman to kill a union organizer. The businessman and the hitman are both guilty of capital murder. The greater onus is on the businessman, whose money made the crime possible. In the Niger Delta, Ogoni rebels have cut Nigeria's oil production in half, putting the squeeze on U.S.-based Chevron Oil, where, incidentally, Condoleezza Rice used to work. According to Amnesty International, hundreds of civilians have been killed in the fighting. The Nigerian government has declared the entire Delta a military zone. No doubt, great crimes are being committed at the behest of Big Oil. Before he was put to death, Ken Sarowiwa predicted that it would come to this. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature a presentation I gave at the University of Chicago on the topic of participatory economics and finance. The presentation was organized by the University of Chicago chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society and recorded on Wednesday, May 19, 2009. I tend to organize my presentations along the lines of a series of questions that I tried to answer. And I'll be doing that for this presentation as well, with the particular focus of finance and the model of economics known as participatory economics. I'll be focusing my remarks on five questions that I'll be addressing in turn, and the list of questions that I'll be addressing is as follows. First, a really basic and probably a quick one: what is finance? Second is, what role does finance play in our economy? A little longer, but I'll probably won't elaborate on it a whole lot. Second is, what is participatory economics? Fourth question is, what role would finance play in a participatory economy? And the fifth question is, what next steps might follow from the remarks that follow from the first four questions? Question number one: what is finance? Well, if you go to the website answers.com, it's a really useful website that I use for finding out about stuff if you need to look up a quick online reference of stuff. And I typed in the word finance. You'll find a number of definitions, a lot of which mimic one another. One that was listed, I think, from the American Heritage Dictionary: the science of the management of money and other assets. The Business Encyclopedia lists finance as the methodology of allocating financial resources with a financial value in an optimal manner to maximize the wealth of a business enterprise. It basically having to do with money in our current economy and the many manifold ways that that can be handled. That leads very quickly to question number two: what role does it play in our economy? Very quickly, it kind of serves as an informal scorecard. Tracking credit, tracking debts, tracking allocation, and many, many manifold ways that that can be handled. But it's more than that. In fact, a lot more than that. Given the fact that within, depending on the economy, if you take a market economy like the one that we're in, markets are a competitive realm by definition. You have participants who basically fill antagonistic roles, who are trying to gain for themselves at the expense of others, or trying to gain something that others can't. And given that realm, finance plays a really critical part, especially where that's basically the scorecard of whether or not you have resources to be able to allocate. Within this entire realm, money is basically serves as a kind of a reflection of power. And prices that are used in this regard serve as a kind of gauge of bargaining power. Oftentimes you'll hear the remark, the classic metaphor that's used by Adam Smith, of an invisible hand as helping to lead markets toward socially constructive goods, even in light of the fact that you may have these antagonistic roles within a market economy. But what some other economists have critiqued is what they term the invisible foot, the various ways in which a market economy can prove to be harmful or detrimental, and which is actually endemic to markets. Some ways of this happening are endemic within the realm of finance. So that, for example, since money itself is an accumulable resource, and since prices themselves are a reflection of bargaining power between actors, usually between producers and consumers, that leads to a whole range of various effects, among them the contestation or concentration of resources within finances and the financial industry. In fact, I just looked this up. Within the last 15 years or so, you found that there has actually been a steady concentration where there are fewer and fewer players holding more and more resources within the financial industry. The number of firms that actually are listed as within the banking sector in the United States have gone down from about 14,000 in roughly 1995 to about 8,000 today, more or less. Now, the number there, I think, is actually is just a small dimension about that kind of concentration of wealth and resources that you find within our economy, and that actually it's actually far worse than that. If you look at the amount of resources that are actually controlled, of the values of the assets and money that is actually controlled, it turns out that about 80% of all money and assets within our economy, within the banking sector, is actually controlled by just 1% of the players that are involved with the economy. That's a consequence of the fact that we are in a competitive realm, and that kind of makes sense. In a competitive realm, since it's you're trying to win at the expense of someone else, obviously you're going to behave or try to behave like a monster in that respect. And since that's going to happen, eventually you're going to find attrition, where fewer players are going to be eliminated because they're bought out or because they're eliminated because they can't compete anymore, and as a result, you will find that concentration of resources. It's endemic within the banking sector, and you can probably pick any sector within our economy, and you will find that this is almost certainly the case. And negative consequences will result. Some of the most negative consequences have really come to light in the last year, and all you have to do is basically look at the front page of any American newspaper and see this, where you found that increasing amounts of money, especially towards speculative ends, have led to bringing our economy on the brink of perhaps collapse. Probably too soon to tell, but it is certainly scary. But it also brought to mind the fact that there a lot of people have considered the idea of economic alternatives. The command planning model that's been mentioned in economies that have called themselves communist or socialist has been one example about this, which has been decidedly critiqued actually from both the left and the right. But in this presentation, and we'll lead now to question number three of my presentation, is another economic model that actually strives to transcend the flaws of both this kind of market model that I've been talking about for the most part and the kind of command planning model that has been one of its major rivals over the last 100 years or so. The model is called participatory economics, and everyone here has a copy of a handout that basically is a quick one-page primer on what the model is and how it might work. Just to talk about this very quickly, the idea of participatory economics is to try to build an economy like any economy would handle the matters of production, consumption, and allocation, but also, where possible, promote a number of values that are deemed important and valuable. And those are encapsulated in the acronym SEEDS, listed as solidarity, equity, efficiency, diversity, and self-management. If you take the initials of each of those values, it spells out the word SEEDS. Those are the goals of the economy wherever possible. How does it try to achieve that? Well, it uses a number of institutions. And I have a quick paragraph here that I'll read that kind of summarizes this. The four main rules of the economy and the procedures of how to try to achieve this in addition to economic goals. One, all jobs in the economy are balanced for desirability and empowerment. Two, remuneration is determined by effort and sacrifice in socially valued labor as gauged by one's closest workmates. Three, economic decisions are made by decision-making bodies comprising those who either work in a workplace or consume in a residence, where those who are impacted by a decision have decision-making power proportional to the degree that they're impacted by that decision. Four, participatory planning procedure addresses allocation, where consumption plans or production plans are submitted with the help of a facilitation mechanism to those who are impacted by those plans. And they're revised, if necessary, by those who made those plans in a series of rounds based on assorted qualitative and quantitative feedback, all done without command planning and done without markets. So that's, in a nutshell, participatory economics. And you can go into much greater detail. In fact, a number of books that are also listed on the handout talk about this at much greater detail than I'll have time to talk about here in this presentation, or maybe even all night. But at least it gives you a taste of the sketch outline of how a participatory economy would work and how it's different from these other economies. So going on to question number four, what role would we see in a kind of financial arrangement within a participatory economy? Well, going back to the institutions that I outlined, payment is handled basically through, you would get paid through being part of a balanced job complex and socially valued labor, so that you would probably be assigned a credit or multiple credits based on the work that you do and based on the effort and sacrifice that you engage in socially valued labor. So if you do something that other people deem valuable and you put measurable effort and sacrifice into that, then you'll get paid. That paid payment would probably come in the form, at least I think so, of a non-accumulable credit. And the reason I think that would be the way to go in a participatory economy is because that kind of the kind of credit would be spent basically by the actor who had earned it, but not be able to use any additional advantage beyond the fair norm of payment according to effort and sacrifice. And in fact, actually, if you look at some of the books that describe this in the literature on participatory economics, where they actually compare a number of payment norms, standards of what people, how should people get paid, and they basically arrive at the conclusion that payment should come solely by effort and sacrifice, tempered by need. And so since that's the norm, you would obviously want to have the credit to be able to gauge that you did work, but you would also not be able to use that to advantage beyond what you did to earn that. And so that would probably come in the form of a non-accumulable credit. You couldn't use that to gain additional credit, unlike now where, like in a stock market, money can ultimately lead to more money in a speculative fashion. But also the fact that no one else can try to spend credits that you accumulate because they obviously didn't earn that, and that wouldn't be fair. And so that's why the institution is set up like that. What you would spend those credits on would be in the form of what the economy a participatory economy calls indicative prices. This is, like any economy, it's going to produce a price, a number that's a quick and dirty measure of the worth of something. Now, in our economy, that's a reflection, as I described earlier, of bargaining power, of how much power a producer would have over a consumer, for example, and also factors regarding supply and demand. But it doesn't take into account other factors that should also be reflected regarding that that particular good or service in the economy. In a participatory economy, they would be, and they would include things like environmental impacts, social impacts, labor costs, in addition to things like supply and demand. And understandably so, because in any given transaction, even though market theory would focus almost exclusively, kind of like as a physicist would try to isolate factors out to try to create an ideal model, there's a problem, though, in that within an ideal model within a market economy, even though you start out by this kind of idealized realm, you basically don't leave that. And that's a big factor because transactions in any economy inevitably lead to other impacts beyond those people who are immediately participating in that transaction. It's more than just if I were to go to a car dealership and buy a car from someone. It isn't just the car dealer and me. It's going to be potentially everyone who could be affected by that, from the people in Detroit who helped to try to make the car, to the people in Chicago who will be breathing the exhausts from the car's transaction, to if I run over someone by accident, obviously they're going to be affected by that. All of those factors are not included within the given price as it currently stands within a market economy. They would in a participatory economy. And that indicative price there would serve as that gauge to be able to determine whether or not something is the worth of something. And so obviously the credits there would, if it turns out that the price of something is too great for various environmental, labor, social, or other factors, then obviously that you wouldn't be able to spend that on that. And the hope would be that since that's handled there, the economy on the whole would be able to make better decisions with regards to factors like labor and the environment and society that our current economy doesn't handle. As far as how this would be handled regarding the allocation, the participatory procedure would be in play where, at least in terms of some large-scale matter regarding, like, say, a year's worth of time, you would have, as far as the broad strokes of what you would consume or produce over a given year, the way that would be handled is basically to make a proposal at a rough description. It could be a very long list or series of lists of the kinds of things you're going to produce or consume over a given time frame. That'll be submitted to whoever is going to be producing or consuming that to see if they can, if that would be a good plan or not, based on various factors like pricing and qualitative feedback, like people feel like factors that can't be brought into a simple number are brought into bear in this economy. And it's another flaw of markets, by the way. But you're basically exchanging proposals. Consumers submit one set of proposals. Producers would submit a complementary set of proposals. They'd be exchanged back, reviewed, submitted back. And if everyone agrees on all of these proposals, then you're done. Chances are, though, that's probably not going to happen with your first go around. So you would have a series of rounds that would actually repeat. At the end of that, the idea would be that overly ambitious proposals would be whittled down to something more realistic. Overly conservative proposals would be ramped up to be more realistic in the other direction. And you would have a plan. Now, that doesn't mean that you're necessarily wedded to that plan in the entire year. Obviously, things will change. New products might emerge in, or other factors that you can't foresee might occur there. Like, I don't know, if a disease outbreak happens during the course of the year that you didn't occur in the planning procedure. And so allocation would need to happen regarding a serum that someone invents to try to get this. Well, you didn't plan for that. But that doesn't mean that credits that you had accumulated over the course of the year can't be spent on that. Good. So you might want to reduce the credits in other aspects of your realm, of your participatory plan, like less ice cream, for example. You could reduce the consumption of that. Credits would be freed up. You could use that to spend on the life-saving serum that you need. And so you would basically be able to handle it that way. So that at the end of the year, you would be able to compare the plan that you make as well as what wound up happening in that final year and how much there was a deviation or lack thereof. But it would also be hopefully a lot more responsive because it would have more information to be able to gauge of, especially now where in market economy you don't have that. In a lot of instances you're flying blind. But in a participatory economy, the institutions allow for a greater involvement and greater information and greater feedback in this regard. So, and that's basically, in a nutshell, how finance, writ large, would play in this participatory economy. And the final question, and I'll be wrapping up right after this, is what are the next steps, or where would we go from here? I would suggest three things. One would be, and in fact, this is actually kind of part and parcel with other political activism that I've done in the last 6 years or so, promotion of the ideas. Try to spread this as widely as possible to as many as people as possible. And that could mean everything from presentations like this to using various social media tools, to going on conventional media, to writing books or plays or anything else to help to try to promote the ideas, or simple, you know, coffee gathering times or something like that. But to promote the ideas, because usually you found that, or at least it's been my experience, that the wider the ideas can be presented, not only the greater feedback can they get regarding the strength of those ideas and whether or not they actually hold any metal, but also that the ideas themselves can also, hopefully, if they are worthy, gain a greater following and over time eventually build up to a critical mass of action that can crystallize into the economy that we're, at least I'm hoping to advocate. That's step number one. Possible step number two would be to critique or attack the existing economic structures that are in play. And that can take in various forms as well. They tend to, at least currently, take the form of the kind of direct political action that you can see, but there are a lot of ways that can be manifest. And so I would advise that, to try to not only attack existing structures, but also in third step that I would advise, to create alternatives. In the almost 20 years since the participatory economic model was proposed, you find that there are a small handful of businesses and other projects that have taken up the mantle of participatory economics to advocate for it, or in some instances to try to implement it and to try to take the lessons learned from that and build beyond that. And also, more importantly, also to serve as an example for others. Hey, if they can do it, maybe I can too. And to hopefully create that alternative coupled with all of these other steps and the theoretical underpinning that I've given a sketch outline of here, hopefully we can achieve that someday.
That was a presentation I gave at the University of Chicago, recorded on May 19, 2009.
The full audio of the presentation and the question and answer session which followed is available online, linked from the website of CAPES, the Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society, at www.chicagoparecon.org. That's www.chicagoparecon.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.